Shalom, and thank you for learning with us. Beth Emmanuel relies on the generosity of our listeners to sustain our Messianic synagogue. Please consider a donation to Beth Emmanuel, where Messianic Judaism is more than an idea. It's really happening.
The Torah portion called Vayeshev begins with the story of Joseph's dreams, Jacob's sons, and the hatred that Joseph's brothers felt for him. Joseph receives prophetic dreams from heaven. The butcher and the baker receive prophetic dreams, which Joseph then interprets. And everything that happens in the Parsha sets up for the next two Torah portions, which eventually bring the reconciliation of Joseph and his brothers, when love finally wins out and brings salvation to the sons of Israel. It would have been completely justifiable if Joseph had returned his brothers' hatred for him, and when they showed up in Egypt, then arrested them and sold them on the Egyptian slave market. Do unto others as they did unto you. Follow in the path of fratricide and hatred. But that's not how the story plays out, is it? Instead, Joseph forgives his brothers, reconciles with them, and provides for them so that they can survive the famine. And not only does he save them in the process, but he saves all of Egypt. And he tells his brothers, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great salvation. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. Okay, we're getting ahead of ourselves. I'm looking ahead to upcoming Torah portions and the Joseph story as it plays out. But getting back to Vayeshev, in Vayeshev, we start with Joseph's dreams, and Joseph's brothers refer to him as the master of dreams. He's a dreamer. And you know who else was a big dreamer? The seer Daniel. Yeah, so if you go to the book of Daniel, it starts with these crazy dreams, like Daniel is interpreting the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. He not only interprets his dreams, but he tells him what his dream was. He doesn't even have to hear it. He's able to say to Nebuchadnezzar, I'll tell you exactly what you dreamed. You dreamed this, that, the other thing, and then he tells him exactly what it means. And so Daniel is elevated to this position of an interpreter of dreams, and he holds a place in the administration, not only in Babylon, but also in Persia. And so the story is very much parallel to the Joseph story, isn't it? Daniel is forcibly taken into exile into Babylon, just as Joseph is forcibly taken into Egypt. Daniel interprets dreams in Babylon, just as Joseph interprets dreams in Egypt. And as a result of these interpretations, Daniel achieves a position of power and influence within the government, just as Joseph achieves a power of influence and power in the administration of the government. So if you think about the book of Daniel, this is an insight I had while working on End of Days. If you think about the book of Daniel, all the stories in the first half of the book of Daniel, chapters 1 through 6, prepare the readers to face the drama described in later chapters, chapters 7 through 12. It's very interesting that as Daniel is an interpreter of dreams in chapters 1 through 6, other people's dreams, when he gets to chapters 7 through 12, Daniel is the one who is having dreams, and he cannot interpret them himself. He needs help from heaven, so he prays for help from heaven. The angel Gabriel comes and helps him interpret his dreams, tells him what it is that he's seeing, what's going on in his dreams. And what does he see? He sees this future coming time of trouble that we'll talk about. All right, so it works out like this. If you think about the stories in chapters 1 through 6, the stories in the earlier chapters provide us with heroes and role models. If you think about what's happening in the stories in Daniel 1 through 6, we have role models and heroes for us. You know, we start off with Daniel and his friends who go into Babylon, and they're forced to eat unclean food, non-kosher food, what do? They refuse to do so. And they say, here, test us in this. And they eat only vegetables. And then the next story is Nebuchadnezzar, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar's, the statue, the image. He sees the world empires with the head of gold, and Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon is the head of gold. And so what does Nebuchadnezzar do? He makes a statue, a colossus statue, completely of gold, and makes a rule that everybody has to worship this. You know, this is, everybody has to worship this god that he's created, this colossus. But Daniel's friends refuse to do so. And so they end up going to the fiery furnace. And then we've got the story, of course, of you know, like Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel is told, the rule is, you're not allowed to pray to anyone except to me. Daniel goes to he says, well, I'm going to daven anyway, like I always do. And he opens the windows and davens towards Jerusalem, as he always does, three times a day. And so as a result, he goes to the lion's den. And so on and so forth. So all of these stories in the first half of Daniel 1-6 prepare the readers, they present the readers with a plan for surviving the things that Daniel's going to see in his dreams in chapters 7-12. So these early chapters provide us with heroes for a later generation of Jewish people to emulate as they defy persecution, religious coercion, and the abomination of desolation that's described in later chapters. Just as Daniel's three friends refused to worship the colossus of Nebuchadnezzar, they said, we'll go to the fiery furnace and our God will rescue us. But even if he doesn't, know this, King Nebuchadnezzar, we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up. So then we come to the second half of the book of Daniel, Daniel's dreams and visions. And Daniel foresees a tyrant emerging from the four empires who will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Holy One and will intend to make alterations in times and law. And this tyrant takes possession of the beautiful land and magnifies himself to be equal with God. He removes the regular sacrifices, and he throws down the place of the sanctuary, the temple. He destroys mighty men and holy people, and he deceives people with his treacherous lies. With persuasive words, he coerces those who have turned away from the Torah and been assimilated, but those who know their God will display strength and take action. And this is the Maccabees, the brave Maccabees mentioned in Daniel 11, 30 and 32. So this arch villain, it says in Daniel, will magnify himself in his heart. He will even oppose the prince of princes. His armies will arise and desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation, it says. Then that deceiver will exalt himself and magnify himself above every god and speak monstrous things against the God of Israel, it says in Daniel 11:36. So you get these prophecies in Daniel 7-12, and we know what they mean. They describe the tyrannical megalomaniac Antiochus Epiphanes of the Hanukkah story, who in the 2nd century BCE declared himself to be a god, took possession of the Holy Land, desecrated the temple, erected an idol in the holy place, and attempted to abolish the biblical calendar and Torah observance, and so on and so forth. We know the story from the book of Maccabees, how they were to, he imposed all these laws. They're to stop offering the burnt offerings. They're to sacrifice to his idol. They're to profane the Sabbath and the festivals. They're not allowed to keep the biblical calendar. They're not allowed to study the Torah. They're not allowed to observe the Torah. They're not allowed to circumcise their children. They have to set up idols and shrines for their idols in the local villages. And he begins to sacrifice swine on the altar of the Lord. And then, like, moreover, he's trying to force everybody to eat swine. I mean, it's a big deal for Antiochus Epiphanes. He wants everybody to eat pig. And it's all towards the idea that he has, that he's going to assimilate the Jewish people into the nations, so they will forget the Torah and abandon the commandments and ordinances. And part of this program is He erects an enormous statue in the temple that Daniel refers to as the abomination of desolation. And so you read in the book of Maccabees, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar and built idolatrous altars throughout the cities of Judah in every direction. It's 1 Maccabees 1:54. Okay, so in those days, we find that there were many Jews who accepted his religion, it says in 1 Maccabees. They offered sacrifices to idols and desecrated the Sabbath. But then there's others, such as the brave Maccabees, who emulate the courage of Daniel and his friends and refuse to comply, refuse to cooperate. Okay, and that's basically, that's the setup. Now, as Yeshua looked toward the end of days, he predicted the rise of a new lawless one who, following in the pattern established by Antiochus Epiphanes and Nebuchadnezzar, for that matter, would perpetrate the same crimes and blasphemies. And he predicted the abomination of desolation, which was spoken through Daniel the prophet, once more standing in the holy place, Matthew 24:15. And he warned that in that day, false messiahs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect, even the Jewish people, Matthew 24:24. So in the previous discussion, reason number 5 that I believe Yeshua is the Messiah, we were talking about his message of love and repentance as the cure for the malady of baseless hatred that and fratricide that was going to bring the destruction of the temple. And I was telling you to really understand the significance of Yeshua's teachings about loving one's neighbor. It's necessary to understand them in the context of the absolute storm of political hatred, violence, and terrorism that erupted in the first century. And we see it erupt in the Jewish revolt against Rome. Because in those days, the nation was deeply divided over the issue of Rome itself. Divided over the question of loyalty to Rome. Many of the wealthy and aristocratic class, the Herodians, the Hasmoneans, the Sadducees, the priestly elite, advocated allegiance to Rome, but others, including the Zealots, the majority of the Galileans, and many of the common folk, emulated the heroic story of Judah Maccabee and the brave Maccabee fighters who defeated an imperial power and drove them from the land of Israel less than 2 centuries earlier. They were the heroes, and so the story of the Maccabees became so popular and so powerful, such a programmatic narrative for people in the first century as they are like dealing with Rome, that you'll probably recognize the names of the original Maccabees if we put them in anglicized form. We have the family of a guy named Matthew and his 5 sons, Judas, John, Simon, Lazarus, and Jonathan. Names sound familiar, don't they? So in the days of the Master, inspired by the story of Judah Maccabee and the Hanukkah revolt, people were agitating for revolt against Rome, especially in Galilee. And people like Yeshua's disciples, for example, Simon the Zealot, Simon the Canaan, that means Simon the Zealot, they were part of this, you know, they were part of this zealot movement to agitate for a revolution against Rome. His disciple Judas Iscariot, whose appellation Iscariot might be Ish-Sakari, referring to a zealot cell called the Sakari Zealots. They named themselves after their stilettos. They were assassins. People like Simon Peter and his brother Andrew, who Yeshua refers to Simon Peter as Shimon Bar-Yonah, Simon the son of Jonah, which is puzzling since in another place in the Gospels we learn that Simon Peter's father's name is not Jonah, it's Yochanan. It's not Jonah. But in the Talmud, we learn that the Bar-Yonim, that is, you know, Bar-Yonah in the plural, Bar-Yonim, were another group of zealot revolutionaries, another terrorist cell. So referring to Peter as Bar-Yonah might mean that prior to getting repentance from this repentance from John the Immerser, Peter and his brother were part of a zealot terrorist band. And this means, I should also mention James and John, the sons of thunder. What is that supposed to mean when he refers to them as the sons of thunder? So what we see here is that several of Yeshua's disciples agitated for rebellion against Rome, emulating the heroic Maccabees. Matthew, not so much. But they probably became followers of Yeshua because they hoped that he was the Messiah who would lead them to defeat Rome in the epic battle of Gog and Magog. So Yeshua's teachings about loving one's enemies, and blessed are the meek, and blessed are the peacemakers, and love your neighbor, and love the stranger, love the non-Jew, these were a real shock to the system for the disciples. And his warnings about the abomination of desolation then absolutely came home to them as well, because they knew that story. That was the story of Hanukkah. 10 years after Yeshua warned his disciples to watch for a repeat of Antiochus Epiphanes and his abomination of desolation, the emperor Gaius Caligula singled out the Jews for persecution. This is an amazing story. That's actually, we have it told from two perspectives, not from the New Testament, but rather it's told from the perspective of Philo of Alexandria, who participated in an embassy mission to Rome to try to reason with Caligula, the emperor. And the second source is it's told in great detail from the perspective of Josephus, who as a Galilean would have known the story very well. At the time, he was only 3 years old, but Josephus grew up in Galilee and he knew this story. And this is just such an amazing story. It's puzzling to me. Why is this story not included in the book of Acts? Anyway, I'm going to tell you this story. Consider it a Hanukkah story, okay? The wicked emperor Gaius Caligula, he believes that he's a god. In fact, he's whichever god he wants to be that particular day. He'll dress up as one god one day, another god the other day, but he's always one of the Roman gods. And he wants everybody to worship him. He's a madman. And he finds out that the Jews won't worship him. And so he makes an order saying, all right, from now on, every synagogue must have an idol of me, and you have to reverence the idol of me. Well, this is why Philo and a bunch of ambassadors, Jewish ambassadors, head out from Alexandria to go to Rome to try to reason with the emperor, but he won't receive them. He won't listen to them. Finally, when they get him to acknowledge them, he says to them, oh, yeah, well, you're Jews. You are haters of God. You all hate God because you do not acknowledge that I am a God. And he says, every other nation on the earth already confesses that I am a God. You alone, Jews, refuse to acknowledge me. And is it true that you won't eat pork? This is really what's his answer to him. This is the whole answer he gave them. And then he followed up the embassy by mobilizing the armies of Rome against Galilee and Judea. He ordered the Roman military governor of Syria, a guy with the name like Publius Petronius, to take several legions away from the Parthian front and march toward Jerusalem with the intention of erecting a colossal idol of himself, of the emperor Gaius Caligula in the form of Zeus. And he's supposed to put up this idol, this colossus, this abomination of desolation in the temple, just like Antiochus. All right, so Petronius is no fool. He's well aware that this is going to provoke a mass rebellion of the Jewish people. And there is going to be a lot of bloodshed. And so he takes at least two legions to escort the idol. And you got to think, how are the disciples of Yeshua going to receive this news when they hear that, hey, the Romans are coming with a giant idol that they're going to put up in the temple? Well, they're going to immediately be thinking of the master's predictions. When you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. So as these legions enter the Galilee, they're on their way to Jerusalem. The disciples of Yeshua know that the war of Gog and Magog is upon them. This is exactly what Yeshua had been warning about. And also Petronius knows that there's going to be a massive fight to carry out the emperor's orders. He's expecting to carry out a mass slaughter of Jews. And then something astonishing happened. Something miraculous happened. As the legions of Petronius entered the Galilee, they anticipate meeting an armed uprising of zealots and revolutionaries, but instead, tens of thousands of Jews, men, women, elders, children, come out to meet them. Gathered in open fields and along the roads, they come out to meet the legions, and this is the Roman army is taking up positions, they're getting ready, here it is, here it comes, here it comes. Instead, they bring their whole family, it's not warriors, it's families. And they lay themselves prostrate before the Romans and bare their necks and declare that they are prepared to die rather than to permit the desecration of the temple, rather than permit the idol to be put up in the temple. So it's kind of like following the program of Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We will not comply, even if it costs our lives. And they refuse to take up arms, insisting that they will not resist Rome with weapons, which is not at all like the Maccabees. But neither would they cooperate with sacrilege. So for 40 days, more than a month, they remain in position, blocking the advance of the Roman army, neglecting their agricultural work, not planting their fields, risking famine to demonstrate the depth of their resolve. And I have to ask, where does this come from? How does this happen in Galilee? In revolutionary Galilee? How does this happen among Galileans? In Galileans who have been plotting and planning for nothing other than a revolt against Rome for years. And I'll tell you what I think. I think the disciples of Yeshua, his many, many Galilean followers, led this resistance movement. It has all the indications of the Yeshua movement and none of the indications of the zealots. This level of Mesirat Nefesh, of laying one's life down for one's convictions, this is Yeshua stuff. This non-violence stuff is Yeshua stuff. Look, I'm not a pacifist, and neither were the disciples of Yeshua, and that's not what we're talking about here, but neither were they willing to be revolutionaries and take up weapons. They put the matter in God's hands, and they said, blessed are the meek. They will inherit the land. Blessed are the peacemakers. They will be called sons of God. Bless your enemies and do not curse. Pray for those who persecute you and so forth. It's a different ethic. It's a completely different ethic. And it's the ethic of the cure to baseless hatred that Yeshua taught, that he presented as the way to bring the kingdom and to survive the day of the Lord. It's the message of the gospel. Petronius was deeply moved by this display of discipline, collective nonviolence, and recognizing that enforcement would result in massacre. Now, the Roman governor, Petronius, he's deeply moved by this display of collective nonviolence and self-sacrifice. He doesn't want to send the legions. He's not going to send the legions out to just, okay, go start cutting necks. Instead, you know, he realizes that enforcement of the emperor's orders is going to result in this massacre, an absolute massacre. So what does he do? He delays the order and writes an urgent letter to Caligula explaining the situation and both the religious impossibility of the order and the political consequences that are going to come about and how it's all in all a bad idea and he doesn't think it should go ahead of it. Now, this is something you don't do to the emperor. You don't, you know, a governor or a commander, a battlefield commander, a general doesn't send a message to the emperor saying, no, let's not obey your orders. When the emperor received the letter, predictably, he immediately issued orders for Petronius's execution, for treason and disloyalty and so forth. And he, you know, orders a new governor, a new commander to step in and take charge of the legions and complete the project. He doesn't care if it means war with Judea and Galilee, that's fine. If it means killing every Jew, that doesn't trouble him, that's fine. And so those are the orders, and he sends this letter by, you know, courier. They've got to take it by ship to Galilee. But before the letter arrives in Galilee, a miracle happens. Nace, a miracle. Hanukkah is the season of miracles. In 41 Common Era, and this is how long the standoff has been going, Emperor Gaius Caligula was assassinated by members of his own guard. And then news of the emperor's death was dispatched to the whole empire. And somehow, due to some storm or shipping or something like this, it reached the Roman camp before the emperor's orders reached the Roman camp, and just before the emperor's orders reached the camp. Petronius receives the good news. Hey, guess what? The emperor is dead. And then the next courier comes, and it's the emperor's orders for his execution, which are no longer valid. The emperor is dead. He's gone. And so the legions pack up and they turn around. And the abomination of desolation, which had actually been still under construction in Sidon, was never erected. It was never put up. I believe that the teaching of Yeshua made all the difference in this story. His teachings about love. What would have happened if Petronius met armed resistance when he entered Galilee? Well, we know how that plays out. War. A torchum burned through the Galilee. The legions would have rolled over the Galilee. And I think it's possible that this war would be the war, the real war of Gog and Magog, that brings the end of the world, the final confrontation. But that's not what happened. This is 40 Common Era. The Apostle Paul has not even become a believer yet. That's how early this is happening. The nations have not started to repent yet. If the war of Gog and Magog happens, it's the end for the nations, consumed by fire. But that's not what happened. Why didn't it happen? Because the message of the gospel was at work. 30 years later, it's a totally different story with the Jewish revolt in 66 Common Era. The zealots and terrorism, fratricide, and baseless hatred rule the day. But for a moment, there was a brief moment, a respite, when we saw the power of love and the teaching of Yeshua, and how things could have gone differently even in 70 Common Era. Because this is that one time that love saved the world. Why isn't this story included in the book of Acts? I think it's not included in the book of Acts because Luke prepared the book of Acts, some scholars think, I think this is correct, as a legal brief in the defense of the Apostle Paul to be presented in Rome. And that would have been the original draft. And so he diminished or couldn't even tell a story that told about a resistance movement against Rome. But I wanted to tell you this story to show you the potent power of the teaching of Yeshua. And it has a lot to do with the story of Joseph the dreamer as well. Joseph, who has his prophetic dreams and interprets other people's dreams. Earlier this week, I was in an advisory meeting with several of the contributors to the Emmaus table, and we got on the subject of prophetic dreams. Most of the people are missionaries to the nations, and Bill Schofield was also there, and he has a missionary friend named Aaron Jones in Ireland who reported this apocalyptic dream that he had about Ireland in December of 2024, 1 year ago. In the dream, He was standing on the Irish coastland, looking out to the sea, when he saw a black storm cloud approaching the land, a huge, terrifying black storm cloud, coming on fast. As the cloud advanced, the sky darkened and the daylight quickly dimmed. He looked around, expecting to see people in a state of panic, bracing for the storm in moments before it was about to break. But to his surprise, nobody seemed at all concerned. Everyone was going on about their regular business as if the storm was of no consequence to them. Well, he gets the attention of the nearest fellow and points out the storm cloud, but the fellow simply shrugs and says, it gets dark early in Ireland. The dream needed no interpretation because the missionary to Ireland understood the symbolism. Actually, within the dream, the storm that was approaching land was anti-Semitism. Okay, so the next night he had the exact same dream with the exact same sequence of events, and he heard the exact same dismissive reply. It gets dark early in Ireland. So he's had the dream twice. And then, subsequent to that, he reads the part in the Torah about Pharaoh having his dream twice in Parshat Miketz as a sign that, you know, the repetition of the dream as an indication that this has been decided and it's going to happen. It's been decided in heaven. Well, the next day, the Israeli government withdrew their embassy from Ireland. Israel's ambassador explained that Ireland has taken a more extreme stance than any other country against Israel. Not only that, it was the first to recognize a Palestinian state. And it also supported South Africa's action against Israel at the International Court of Justice by asking the court, petitioning the court, to broaden its interpretation of what constitutes the commission of genocide by a state. In other words, Ireland asked the court to redefine the meaning of the word genocide in order to condemn Israel. All right. Now, for the record, my mom was a Kelly. The rock band U2 was my favorite band. And I like Guinness. So I'm not hating on the Irish. I'm just stating the situation. This missionary to Ireland reported the dream a year ago. And today, a year later, there is no question that Ireland leads Europe in open societal demonstration of anti-Semitism, even at a government level, anti-Jewish rhetoric, anti-Israel policies. So yeah, it gets dark early in Ireland. And that can be understood to simply mean that Ireland is a little ahead of the curve in the world's mad rush toward Gog and Magog. Also in that meeting, you know, Bill Schofield was there, as I said, Bill Schofield of the Apocalyptic Gospel Podcast, and we heard a story about Bill's recent dream. In the dream, Bill was with the Master, and Yeshua was speaking to him, and he said to him directly, "I have a message I need delivered to the nations. I've said it before many times, but I'm only going to say it one more time. This is the last warning. Love one another as I have loved you, and I will give the fear of the Lord to my ecclesia." So night comes early to Ireland. So I presented this message to Beth Emmanuel the day before Hanukkah. The next morning, I got up very early in the morning to get to work, Sunday morning. And what do I see in the news? But first day of Hanukkah, there was a massacre of Jewish people at a Hanukkah lighting in Australia. Ireland may be the beginning, but the other nations are following. And we need to start preparing now in the art of Yeshua's teachings. And it starts with love one another and love your neighbor and love the stranger. We need to, like the Hanukkah light that gets brighter and brighter as the days of Hanukkah go on and we add more and more light, we need to add more and more light. And that light is the love of God. Happy Hanukkah. No!